Welcome to The Forum on 90.5 WCBE, bringing you the conversation shaping Columbus, straight from the not-for-profit Columbus Metropolitan Club. Every Wednesday in downtown Columbus, community leaders and local voices like yours come together to tackle the issues that matter most to Central Ohio. Want to join us in person? Tickets and details about upcoming forums are available at columbusmetroclub.org. What if the way we move is shaping the way we live, but not for the better? This week's conversation explores how rethinking urban transportation could transform our communities. Joining us this week are Sarah Goodyear and Doug Gordon. They're the co-authors of the new national best-selling book, Life After Cars, Freeing Ourselves from the Tyranny of the Automobile. We're also joined by Deviani Puranik. She's the Mobility Development Program Director for COTA. Your host is Delaviance Burt Sims, board member with Transit Columbus. Let's dive into this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, Life After Cars, Reimagining Cities for People.
All right, good morning, or actually good afternoon now, everyone. So for our panelists, to just jump straight in one sentence or less, how did you guys get here today?
Physically or emotionally, mentally, spiritually?
Well, emotionally, it might be a little bit drab outside, but let's think physically, talk transportation.
We took COTA.
Yeah, the bus.
Yes. Awesome. The bus.
That was the perfect answer. Yes, I also took the bus.
Awesome. Okay. So this first question is for you, Doug and Sarah. So we want to know, where does the actual history of cars begin? And not necessarily talking about like that first Model T that rolled off the line, making cars more accessible to millions of Americans. However, let's talk a little bit about the resistance to cars, and specifically, how did people, like regular people in Ohio, have to have a role to play in that?
So in chapter one of our book, we talk about that history. There's a really great book that we use as reference called Fighting Traffic by historian Peter Norton at the University of Virginia. And, you know, we're kind of told that the Model T rolled off the assembly line. It made it affordable to the masses. And America's quote-unquote love affair with the automobile began. And it's been a love affair ever since. That really wasn't true. When cars entered the scene, they were seen as menaces to people in cities specifically. They were killing hundreds of people in cities, thousands of people in cities per year, many of them children. And as we sort of talk about in the book, cities had not seen that level of mechanized death on their streets outside of a war. It just nothing had visited so much tragedy upon people. And it was largely seen as a technology that benefited the rich, that benefited the privileged. It was you would take your car to go to the country. Nobody drove to work. And so there was a huge amount of resistance. Memorials popped up in Indianapolis, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, New York, Chicago, memorials to the dead, big obelisks that looked like World War I memorials, to memorialize largely the children who were killed. This was pushed back heavily by, we actually tell the story of Columbus, Cincinnati. There was a plan to limit the speed of cars, to put a mechanical speed governor in cars in the 1920s. And there was a huge push for this, like 40,000 people signed a petition to get this on the ballot. The automobile companies, the car dealerships, the auto clubs, the enthusiast clubs, not like AAA, pushed back against this, put newspaper ads, sent letters to every registered car owner in the city of Cincinnati saying, if you do this and limit the speed of cars to 20 miles an hour, it will put what they called a Great Wall of China around the city, and people would take their business to Indianapolis, to other cities, and it got defeated because of this pushback. And then we get things like the invention of jaywalking, which is a term that was invented by the car industry. So the story we've been sold, even that phrase, love affair with the American's love affair with the automobile, comes from essentially an infomercial in 1963 sponsored by DuPont, which was a majority stakeholder in General Motors. So part of what we're trying to do with the book is say this was not the result of just pure market forces and preferences. This was a sustained campaign to trap us all into the many problems of automobile dependence.
Sarah, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's really the whites, they used to call parents who had lost a child to traffic violence a white star family. And, you know, sitting here in this memorial here where, you know, gold star families or people who've lost family members in combat, I think it's really important to realize that we called our book Life After Cars, and it's an invitation to imagine something, because what we don't have a living memory of here in on this planet any longer is what life before cars was like. And so I think it's really important to look to this history and to realize that people who did come from the era of life before cars, when cars entered the picture, their destructive force was apparent to people, and they did fight against it. And it was, in some ways, considered to be like a war on our cities. And again, as Doug said, the people who drove were the elite. And so there was a lot of class issues there too. So I think that all of that kind of is really useful to call into our present day memory, so that we can realize that this is a social construct, the way that we live today. It can be modified and changed. It will change. And we are just hoping to make positive human-centered change, and not change that is just benefiting multinational fossil fuel corporations and auto manufacturers and the people who benefit from those industries.
Thank you. And turning over to our friends at CODA, Deviani, let's talk about this history a little closer to home. So what's a brief history of transit in Central Ohio during the 20th century?
Yeah, CODA has interesting history. And as Doug and Sarah mentioned, several cities were thriving on transit before. That was life before cars. So as I understand, late 1800s, early 1900s, we had horse-drawn streetcars, and those were converted to electric streetcars. I believe West Broad Street was a corridor where streetcars were functioning really well. In the 30s, and you know, until then, there is recorded ridership, and I have not validated, so don't quote me on that, but we had 80 million in ridership. And after 30s and 40s, when life after car began, that ridership dropped down almost to 15 million rides. And at that time, Columbus Transit Company was a private company that was operating just basic bus network. The streetcars were converted into trolley buses, and that was also killed around, I want to say, 1960s or 70s. And in 1974, CODA became official public agency for transit in Columbus region. So really interesting ups and downs until then. And then CODA, for decades after that, operated a basic bus service because it was treated as an option, not really infrastructure investment. More recently, though, in 2014 to 2017, CODA went through a massive transit system redesign. And that's when we developed a expanded network for our region. Our region was growing at that time, too. And so in that, we introduced several new connections, alignments, and all of that. And we saw huge uptake in ridership in 2019. So that was our highest ridership year, 2019. And then we all know what happened after. So through COVID, like many, many transit agencies, we also saw loss in ridership. There was no traffic, people were not going anywhere. But because it's an essential service, we continued to work through COVID. Our operators continued to show up at work, and we were the essential service for several nurses and doctors and other employment employees. And then 2024 is a big moment in history for us, actually. Our levy passed, and that's when Linca's vision became a reality for us. Just curious, how many of you have heard about Linca's? Okay, so for those who have not, please go to our website. It's an amazing vision that we have developed for 2050 with our partners with MORPC, City of Columbus, Franklin County, and all of our community partners in the region to create that extensive mobility system, not just through buses, but several other components too. And at the same time, we are working through BRT corridors. One is proposed on this street itself, and then also enhancing our fixed route system. So a lot to come through our planning and our visioning and implementation in the next 5 years. So stay tuned. It doesn't feel like change in history happens that fast, but it is happening. And I feel like we are coming back. It's a full circle moment with Linka's vision being implemented.
Okay. And yeah, I think in 2019, Coda hit their highest ridership since the 1980s at 20 million or 24 million rides, which was a great milestone. So keeping this on focused on Coda, Deviani, you're an economic development person. Let's talk a little bit about the economic returns or quality of life improvements that Columbus has left on the table by focusing primarily on planning for cars and assuming everyone will eventually just get one.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. When the city is designed based on the assumption of based on the assumptions that everyone just eventually get cars, I feel like we are quietly excluding people from opportunities. We leave workforce participation on the table when someone cannot reach to their job. We leave healthcare outcomes on the table when somebody cannot get to their medical appointment. We leave housing choices on the table when somebody has to choose between affordability, commute distance, and schools. So there is so much human cost associated with all of that. And not just human cost, it's extremely expensive to own and maintain a car. So I believe it's about $13,000 to $14,000 per year to own and maintain a car. And for a worker on minimum wages, it's not the expectation that we should have from somebody like that. And then maintenance on cities too, no, it's just not personal expense, it's on cities to maintain the infrastructure, parking, keeping on building new surface lots. It's a lot of cost economically too. But I would say from some of our peer city examples, for example, Twin Cities, once they developed their BRT system, they saw about $19 billion in private investment along the corridors. They saw 60,000 new housing units that were transit-supported TOD, transit-oriented development. And then that happened just on 4% of land. So they have seen, we have examples where it's very successfully economically implemented. And this is the time with Linkus, with partnership, we have that opportunity to make that vision come true. We ourselves are leading West Broad Transit-Oriented Development Plan, and through that analysis on all three corridors with zone-in changes that Columbus worked on, we see there is potential for about 88,000 new housing units along the corridors. Again, saying 88,000 new housing units along the corridor. So when we speak of numbers, that's incredible and really, really impressive to make that economic development vision real.
Yeah, and housing is going to be a really big topic over the next 25 to 50 years of development in Columbus. For our War on Cars podcast host, beyond lost time, money, and childhood, tell me more about some of the silent negative externalities of car-centric city infrastructure. And specifically, I want to touch on a very emotional point. Your book actually brought me to tears more than once, and I don't cry often. I really should, but you know, I haven't had much of a chance recently, except for when I read your book. I realize, you know, as I'm getting older and more mature, I'm realizing that, you know, being careful isn't always enough. You know, wearing the right clothing, making sure that, you know, like I'm reflective, I'm wearing my helmet, all that good stuff. It's sometimes it's just not enough, especially when the infrastructure is not there to support it. Could you talk a little bit about the, you know, real injustices people have faced, and specifically cases like Raquel Nelson's matter for how we discuss issues of transportation?
Yes. So Raquel Nelson is a mother who lived in suburban Cobb County in Georgia, which is outside of Atlanta. And she did not own a car. She had three small children. And one day she took her kids on the bus for a shopping trip and got pizza and they were on their way back, their apartment complex was across the street from their bus stop. And it was a long bus journey home, as it so often is. And when they got out, everybody who was on the bus did what they always do, which was to cross the road illegally at that place because there's no crosswalk connecting the apartment building to the bus stop. And the nearest crosswalk was a third of a mile walk in one direction. And then, of course, that's going to add 2/3 of a mile. And after you've been out with your kids shopping all day, you're not going to do that. And so they followed the other bus riders, thinking that they had a good enough gap in traffic to get across this very busy arterial road. And her son, AJ, went out ahead of her and was struck by a driver who was visually impaired and also on substances. Raquel Nelson, the mother, was charged with vehicular homicide for her son's death. And she ended up being convicted and sentenced to, I think, some time in jail. She didn't actually do that. She ended up appealing it. But this is the kind of situation that we put people in when we build our communities like this. We are stranding them often by the side of a road that most people in this room have maybe never had the experience of walking down one of these roads and understanding what is truly happening when you get off a bus and you can't cross the road in a legal place, but you end up doing what human beings do, which is to take the shortest distance, and planners haven't accounted for that. And, you know, fortunately, eventually she was able to get exonerated. I mean, but this was after years of, you know, she was on the Today Show and she was, you know, there was a lot of press attention to her case because it was so dramatic. But it's certainly not the only case in which parents have been criminally charged when their children are hurt by drivers. That has happened in other cases since. So what we're essentially doing is we're criminalizing normal human behavior. We're criminalizing walking and we're making and then the other negative externalities that come out of that. I mean, that is bad enough, but you have 40,000 fatalities per year in this country. That's a rate of about 14 per 100,000. It's twice easily what any other wealthy nation in the world has. It's comparable to developing nations in Africa and Asia, and it doesn't even compare favorably to it. It's like the rate of Kazakhstan, for instance, is similar to ours. In Canada, it's 4.2 per 100,000. Canada is a nation that has essentially the same setup we do, but they take much more care with public health. And so that's bad enough, but it's not just the fatalities. There's also hundreds of thousands of injuries, of course, and many of those are life-altering. And when we talk about a life-altering injury, we're talking about, you know, people being left in vegetative states. We're talking about people who are going to have limbs amputated. We're talking about really, really bad outcomes for people. And then you have to add in the other passive health effects from air pollution and noise pollution and cardiovascular disease, which is the leading killer of people in the United States, is heavily impacted. And it's been shown in study after study after study that high blood pressure, asthma, heart attacks, cognitive decline, cognitive delay in children, low birth weight in children, all of these things are directly affected by automobile emissions. And that's the primary cause of the pollution that we have in our cities. And then noise pollution also contributes to high cortisol levels, which, you know, contribute to all a host of these ailments. So I think that what we don't see is, our sedentary lifestyles also affect our health. So this is a huge public health issue. And we did an episode two episodes ago where a physician who had come to one of our readings and had said, you know, I really need to talk. I work in a long-term care facility with patients who are on ventilators, and most of them are victims of traffic violence, and most of them are Black and brown, and their families are devastated, and nothing will ever be the same for these families. And he told his story of what it's like to be a physician caring for these patients. He's a young man. He's really passionate about this. And we've gotten emails from other physicians around the country who are really interested in trying to make common cause, because this is a public health disaster, essentially, that is happening in our nation. It's happening without us even thinking about it or talking about it most of the time.
So sort of continuing in that vein a little bit, you know, when I was growing up, my mom really didn't want me to take the bus or ride my bike around because, you know, obviously she's rightfully scared, you know, that something, you know, the worst could happen. You know, could we talk about some of the benefits to fixing this issue that benefits not only just children, but also the other classes of the 1/3 of Americans who cannot drive a car?
We had a guest on the show, Anna Zivartz, wrote a book called When Driving is Not an Option, and one of the stats she cites is that 30% of Americans do not have a driver's license. Now, that includes children, it includes elderly people who have aged out of driving and chosen not to drive anymore, but it includes people with disabilities that prevent them from driving, people with anxiety, people who have just said, I don't want to drive, undocumented people who can't get a license for any, you know, number of reasons, and yet we have centered our transportation system on expecting all of those people at some point to either own a car or have access to a car. And, you know, I think it's probably true here in New York City. Elderly people make up something like 15% of the population, but they are way overrepresented in traffic fatalities. So it's not just kids. It's at every stage of life. And you know, what do we want for ourselves as we age, for example? We want community. We talk in the book about the loneliness epidemic, and the former Surgeon General under Biden wrote a report. It was a big thing of his, the loneliness epidemic. And as we write in the book, if you do a search in that report for parking, cars, automobile, sprawl, no mentions. Like, that is really what's driving our... It's not screens, you know. My kids, we live in Brooklyn, and we are both parents, and my kids are on screens as much as any other kid. But what they are not doing is just sitting in their room wondering, how can I get places to go see my other friends? Because we live in a walkable, bikeable place. They can take the subway, they can take the bus. We have a park two blocks away. Numerous businesses that are kid-friendly will allow them to sit there and have ice cream or coffee or whatever. And that's what we need. That's part of it too. So it's not just the elderly. It's not just freedom for kids. It's all of us. We're social animals. We're meant to collaborate with each other, and we get separated into these little boxes, and then we have nothing but transactional relationships with other human beings who aren't our family or our coworkers. And that's not how we evolved to live.
Yeah. So switching back over to Columbus and, you know, the Link Us project. So this is funded in part by that 0.5% sales tax that was successfully passed in 2024. The Link Us project is often described as planning for a more car optional future that also could help us solve some of the problems that we've touched on during this conversation. But what I want to know, and what other many people want to know, is you know, how does it respond to the fact that my generation is driving less, wants to drive less? That's Gen Z, by the way. I'm very young, sorry. and how does it? What does it change for, you know? Honestly, not even older people at this point, because as I'm coming into adulthood, I've frankly not been able to rely on COTA as much to get me to where I need to go in a timely manner. So what does it change for someone that wants to get to places on time, like a doctor's appointment or taking a flight?
Yeah, I think generation Gen Z and several here in the audience too are pushing us to think differently. They are exposing what is really important. And it's not about just car ownership, but it's having options and not forced into doing something that is not economically viable, it's not sustainable, it's not safe. So thank you, Gen Z, for pushing us to think a little bit differently. But I would say Link Us, as I mentioned earlier, we are thinking about it as a regional mobility system. As you mentioned, it is funded through 0.5% new sales tax, so that was a huge first step to start building the foundation. Linkers includes not just BRT corridors, which is bus rapid transit along three corridors. That work is currently underway very fast, and it's happening. But outside of Linkers, our fixed route system, and we hear every single day from residents in Kota service area about what about frequency, what about additional alignments. And that's the work we are doing currently through our five-year plan, short-range transit plan. I'm going to put a little plug in. We are hosting public meetings this week, so if you're not doing anything tonight, please attend our public meeting and give us comments. We would really appreciate that. But based on public feedback, we are building or we are thinking about at least 14 different lines that will have improved frequency, weekday and weekends. We have a new alignment connecting hospitals, so connecting OSU Dublin all the way to OSU main campus downtown. Connecting OSU and Hamilton Quarter. These are the hospital connections that we have been hearing from public for a long time. There is a new line proposed in our short-range transit plan recommendations to connect OSU to airport and downtown, so that's a big connection that we are looking at. So again, we are looking into adding about 20 to 30% new service or more service in next 5 years. Again, 5 years is not overnight, so it will take some time, but we will get there. And beyond that, for everybody, millions of dollars are invested in transit supportive infrastructure, meaning shared use paths, sidewalks. We know that 96% of our riders walk to our system. And it's not just for our riders, it's for everybody trying to walk to different destinations. So we know the importance of that, and so transit supportive infrastructure is a big piece of Linkers' vision as well. So again, like I mentioned, it's the full mobility system, and specifically for Gen Z, some of the other tech options like tap to pay or app-based scheduling, a lot of those are introduced as well. So, but I'll be honest, every single car trip cannot be replaced by Kota as yet, but we are definitely moving forward with.
I do love to hear that. There, I want to get back on the bus. I really like it. So back to our War on Cars podcast hosts, Sarah and Doug. You've been in Columbus for a few days. You've been on a bike tour. You used the bus. I even think that you might have rented a car to drive around on occasion.
No, we took from the airport.
Only from the airport.
Ride hail. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I even used the car in the last week. Okay.
You're listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. Over the last century, cities were built for cars, but they don't have to stay that way. This week, we're exploring how new approaches to urban mobility can create more connected and livable communities. Joining us this week are Sarah Goodyear and Doug Gordon. They're the co-authors of the new national best-selling book, Life After Cars, Freeing Ourselves from the Tyranny of the Automobile. We're also joined by Deviani Puranik. She's the Mobility Development Program Director for COTA. Your host is DeLaviance Burt Sims, board member with Transit Columbus. We'll get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, Life After Cars, Reimagining Cities for People, after a short break.
Do you love amazing stories? I know I do. I'm Michael Kent, and every week on my show, we examine something from history that's so unbelievable it sounds made up, but is 100% verifiably true. It's a podcast called The Internet Says It's True, and there are hundreds of episodes to choose from. For example, did you know the story of how Leonard Nimoy came up with Live Long and Prosper for Star Trek? Or how Colombia is dealing with a hippo problem that goes back directly to Pablo Escobar? Or one of my favorite stories, a man figured out that a nondescript Winnebago being auctioned online was actually an important part of space exploration history. These are all stories from The Internet Says It's True. Listening to a podcast has never been easier. You can listen through any popular podcast app, through the NPR app, or download the fantastic new WCBE app, click the Podcasts tab, and look for The Internet Says It's True with Michael Kent. You'll have so many stories up your sleeve, you'll feel like the smartest person in the room, especially if you're home alone.
Hi there, this is Morgan James. Every album represents a step in an artist's journey. Hello, music lovers. I'm inviting you to listen to Music Journeys with Mike Foley. Mike mixes music and conversation with artists to share what informed and inspired their latest project, how the love of music began, what music means to them, and so much more. We've chatted about three of my projects, the most recent being Soul Remains the Same, a soul album of songs you would never expect. You can always expect the perfect combination of music and stories on Music Journeys. The show airs Saturday afternoons at 3:30 on WCBE. Recent episodes are available on the major podcast platforms and the WCBE app. To meet and hear more from all the musicians featured since its start in 2018, including me, to be the first to be featured three times on the show, look for Music Journeys on WCBE's podcast experience at WCBE.org.
Welcome back to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. What if the way we move is shaping the way we live, but not for the better? This week's conversation explores how rethinking urban transportation could transform our communities. Joining us this week are Sarah Goodyear and Doug Gordon. They're the co-authors of the new national best-selling book, Life After Cars, Freeing Ourselves from the Tyranny of the Automobile. We're also joined by Devyani Puranik. She's the Mobility Development Program Director for COTA. Your host is Delaviance Burt Sims, board member with Transit Columbus. Let's get back to this week's Columbus Metro Club Forum, Life After Cars, Reimagining Cities for People.
So I do want you guys to be honest. How far are we from our dreams or my dream of our neighbors going car light or even car free? And what works well in your experience when it comes to us, the constituents of COTA and the users of COTA holding COTA accountable to the promise that they made to us back in November of 2024?
So we're experts on Columbus by now because we've been here since Monday.
48 hours plus.
Yeah. Right, exactly. We've had nothing but decent experiences on COTA. We did actually last night have to, on our way to our event at OSU, we waited like 20 minutes for about, it was just delayed at rush hour. We weren't the only people waiting, just watching car after car after car go down High Street. So, dedicated bus lanes would be a good thing. Signal priority for buses would be a good thing. I think we've been talking to people about the challenges you face in Columbus because you're so sprawled out and you're really sort of lots of different types of municipalities making up one city. So there isn't going to be a one-size-fits-all solution. However, I look around and I say, wow, look at these wide streets, these like five or six lane one ways where you could take one entire lane of car traffic and not have any impact on drivers whatsoever. Level of service would remain the same for drivers, and turn it into a bus lane and turn it into a two-way protected bike lane. And I know there are plans through some of the stuff that we got a tour of the other day. So I see that as amazing. I think Columbus is behind a lot of the other cities we've seen. There isn't a lot of like protected on-street bicycle infrastructure, for example, but it feels like Columbus could catch up very quickly, given, first of all, the geometry. There's just lots of space. And if the political leadership can kind of catch up to where I feel like a lot of the planners and the people inside city government, the people running transit, are and what they want to do. So that's, to me, very encouraging.
Yeah, I'd have to say that I see Columbus as a place that has just so much potential that's very close to being able to be realized. So as Doug said, the space is there. The advocacy community, shout out to Transit Columbus and Yay Bikes and others, all aboard Ohio. You know, there's a strong advocacy community. It's young people. It's people who really understand this community. Every solution will have to be tailored. Having a fantastic educational institution like OSU is another great thing, because the research that's being done and the intellectual level that the discourse is at is very high here, I think. And, you know, also you're growing, you have money. You know, a lot of places that we've been, I'm thinking of Memphis, for instance, you know, is really still experiencing that sort of urban decline cycle that was plaguing U.S. cities for much of the
last 20 years of the 20th century and coming into the 21st century. So I think Columbus has all of the ingredients. It's obviously, as this room proves, it's a very civic-minded community. I think that there is a real sense of pride in this community and a real desire to make Columbus the best it can be. And so I think all of those are huge assets. But you also have this entrenched car culture. So it's a question of, I think, communicating to people and for CODA to be able to communicate to the residents of this region, what are you going to get for what you voted for? How is that going to work? And really helping people understand. I've said in a few of the cities we've been in, a lot of American cities struggle to communicate the best laid plans of planners to their residents because a lot of Americans have only been car dependent. They've only known car dependence. They haven't known what it's like to live in a walkable city. And so the skills of how do you use transit? How do you use bike lanes? What is safe? How do I enjoy a city in this way? It's almost like there's remedial education that's necessary, frankly, to sort of make the new city legible to its residents. And so I think that that's a real challenge for transit agencies, for planners, for electeds, and for advocates to help to communicate to the residents of the city, both through design solutions and through just talking and doing other kinds of, I mean, Stevie Passamonte, shout out to Transit Columbus over there, you know, is talking about, you know, if you have a friend who is like, oh, the bus, I don't know about the bus. Like, I've never ridden the bus. It seems so scary. I don't know how to do it. Just say like, okay, I'll ride with you. Let's ride to work tomorrow together. I'll come pick you up. I'll bike with you to do something. You know, helping people understand how to use their city in a new way is really important because, you know, as it is, we're just, you know, like you drive, you park, you walk a block, you go back, you drive again, you park in your driveway, you don't know what it's like. And then you go on vacation to Europe or Disneyland. You're like, wow, this is great to be able to walk around and like get around in different ways and use transit. Like we need to be helping people to see their own communities in that way.
One other thing that we've heard is that it's way too easy to drive here. It's like the best commute city, right? So like you don't have the urgency that say in Atlanta has where it's like you cannot build out the road capacity through the highway, through the city anymore, and people feel like this is it. It's taking me 40 minutes to go 4 miles. So that can lead to a lack of urgency to solving these problems. But I think it also represents an opportunity in that you have the space, like I said.
So we are nearing our end here because we're at time. But I have one more question for the panelists. But because we're at time, we're going to keep it really short. So we're going to do one sentence. I'm an organizer, and so I have to do a call to action at the end of everything that I do. If we are serious about becoming the best in the Midwest, what is an action that everyone here could take starting today to get us to that place that we want to be in the next 5 years? All panelists can answer.
I'm going to start, and I'm going to say join an organization, because organizing is the most important. So join an organization like Transit Columbus or similar.
Call your elected officials and tell them you like something. You know, we often call our elected officials to complain about potholes or, you know, the streetlights out on our block or whatever, but say like, I rode the bus yesterday and it got me to the Crew game and I didn't have to pay for parking. I want more of that so I can do more things like that. Call them to tell them you want more bike lanes, bus lanes, walkability, safety, all the rest.
And I would say choose it. At least take one transit ride where you would have driven in car otherwise, and then demonstrate the demand.
All right. Thank you so much, everyone. It is the Columbus Metropolitan Club's long-standing tradition to take audience questions. This is where we'll get interactive. We'll move to questions from our live stream. So if you're on the live stream, feel free to put questions in the chat. And in the in-person questions will be held over there by Doug. Yes, communication is a two-way street. If you have questions, now is the perfect time to walk on over to the microphone. And remember, again, if you're on the live stream, drop your questions in the chat. Panelist, that was it. Sorry, actually, I already asked your last question.
Lavance, thank you so much. Thank you so much, and thank you so much to today's panelists. Great conversation. We are getting some questions here. Yes, please line up behind me, and we'll try to get to as many of your questions as we can. And if you're watching online, type your question in the chat. We'll try to get to as many of those as we can. Also, great questions at CMC always have two things in common. They can be asked in just one or two sentences. They are short. And for our repeat guests, what punctuation mark does a question always end with? They need to end with a question mark. Yes, thank you very much. I'm going to launch us off with this one. Okay, will autonomous vehicles have an impact on car dependency? Will they reduce it? Will they increase it? Will they have no effect?
The most recent research, which is just emerging, is that they are not really reducing car dependence in the places like San Francisco where they are most prevalent. And I do fear that they could potentially increase it. And it's a complicated question. There are a lot of great things about autonomous vehicles, but they are cars. And so they are could potentially even increase the number of cars that we're using.
I'd say two things. We were mentioning like going on vacation to Europe or Disneyland. No one has ever gone to Paris and said, you know what would make this place better? Robot cars. Nobody. Like the places we seek out, we know. Also, we've done this experiment with Uber and Lyft. The great promise of Uber and Lyft was you wouldn't need your own car. You could summon a car on demand. It would whisk you to your destination. You don't have to worry about parking. The car will just leave. Great. However, it led to a lot of deadheading, which is the driver searching for their next ride, which led to an explosion in vehicle miles traveled. And a lot of the traffic that we saw increase in places like New York was attributable to that deadheading. AVs will only make that problem exponentially worse.
I'm Scott Whitlock, a member of the Metropolitan Club. I am certainly biased because I am still involved and have been involved with the automobile industry for more than 40 years, for 10 of them as the senior American at Honda of America Manufacturing, including making well over a million cars as plant manager at the Marysville Auto Plant. But my question goes to cost. For COTA, if I were to take the total number of passenger miles and divide it into what appears to be the total cost of providing the bus service on the annual statement, what would I get as the result of the cost per passenger mile?
I will have to get back to you with the specific number, but I would say that, you know, if I don't know if you have, any of you have seen a picture where 50 people go in a bus, 50 in a car, 50 on a bike. That's a powerful picture just to show the power of transit. The cost, yes, it's a big number to think about. But all of our highways are subsidized through tax money. All congestion is subsidized. So the cost exists for everything, including transit.
Well, I've done that calculation, and the cost is more than $8 per passenger mile. Wow.
Have you done the calculation for highway? I'm just curious.
For COTA.
For highway. Have you done the calculation for how much highways cost? I mean, you know, everything does cost.
I guess so I would say this. I think it's called bus service, however, right? It's not called bus business. And for every dollar we spend on highways and car infrastructure, we then have to pay much more than that in maintaining that infrastructure in the cost that we were talking about. For every dollar we spend on transit, on active transportation like bike lanes, society gets back that money in lower healthcare costs, economic costs, things like that. So yes, there are costs associated, and there's no transit service in this country that runs a profit. But again, it's like the U.S. Postal Service, the transit service. There are certain things that we do in this country because they provide a service to people that benefits the economy in ways that are not necessarily calculable in the direct ledger sheet of the agency that provides the service.
Hi, my question is about Mexico City. There was an initiative down there when Claudia Sheinbaum was the mayor of Mexico City to essentially improve street safety. So they're making a lot of the same changes that you talk about in your book, but basically they're widening sidewalks, better lit, more visible crosswalks and so forth. Can you guys comment on that? Are you familiar with that case study?
I've never been to Mexico City, so I couldn't really comment on it. But I mean, I think the one thing I can say is like, these are things that are replicable easily in any city. Like wider sidewalks would be great. Safer crosswalks, so it's easier and safer to cross. Raised crosswalks in places where people need them to slow down drivers. Like, yeah, this is, you know, it's, we've been saying every city is going to have its own flavor. What works in New York, what works in Mexico City is not necessarily going to be a one-to-one transfer here, but a lot of these things are similar. I always compare it to like medical patients. Like, we know that this drug works across different populations, but the dosage for this person might be a little different than for this person, and there are demographic differences. So that's sort of how I see it.
Hello, my name is Olive Angelimi. I'm with the Superintendent Student Ambassadors. And I have recently started riding the Dakota to get me around places I'm going. And I noticed that there was an accommodation for someone with a wheelchair. Are there like other accommodations you're looking into adding or implementing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So all of our fixed route buses are ADA accessible, and our drivers are trained to help somebody needing assistance. But additionally, we also run a service called Mainstream that is and specifically meant for ADA people with disabilities. And they provide even more assistance to people who need it. With Mainstream, there is complimentary service, Mainstream on demand, so that people can actually schedule service as they need. And they just need to get qualified at our mobility center once, but after that, they can ride our service as much as they would like. Additionally, our on-demand zones, all of our zones have AD accessible vans. So we have anything and everything that we can help and support our ADA community as well.
Thank you. My name is Mohamedou. I'm a sophomore, and I've run COTA for the last 2 years, and it's a pretty fun experience, in my opinion. But my question today will be, without cars, and what would happen to the medical patients or pregnant women that need to be rushed to a hospital in times of emergency?
Yeah, our argument in the book is not, it's not life without cars. It's more life after forced car dependency. That's sort of what we're arguing. So yes, a medical emergency, a car is probably going to be one of the best tools for the job. And that's how we see mobility as a tool, right? Like a bicycle is going to be probably the best tool for me to get from here to downtown, or the bus is going to be the best tool. If I'm going on a camping trip, an SUV filled with my stuff and my kids is going to be the best tool. Our argument in the book is that we have just basically said to everybody, like, you get one tool. No matter what the job is, you have one very expensive, very heavy, very large, very dangerous tool, and you have to use it for everything. So if you're elderly, if you have the kind of disability that means that you have to drive or be driven, great. You should want people like me to not ever have to get into a car. That would be better for you. So yeah, it's not an absolute argument is what we're making. But I think, you know, that's a great question. Like, we have to be concerned for the people for whom a car is going to be the best tool for the job for them in that situation.
Yeah, and I'd like to add that, you know, getting more people out of cars and using more spatially efficient transportation methods can reduce traffic and reduce delays for emergency vehicles and create every car that's off the road, right? If somebody is in a need to rush to the hospital, that's going to ease their way. And so, yes, of course, cars are very important to use for certain things, but not for everything. As Doug often says, you don't want to use a sledgehammer to, you know, bust your wall up and also to hang a picture, because then you'll bust your wall before, yeah. You know, yeah, so. Yeah.
Hi, question for Sarah and Doug. If you're to offer one tactic, and I'll say maybe like the more guerrilla warfare, like the better, for the average citizen to try and undermine the car lobby agenda, what would that be?
Is this really the venue to talk about this? I feel like this is for you, Doug.
Yeah, I mean, I think, talking about guerrilla, we have a chapter in the book about like people kind of taking matters into their own hands and installing pop-up bike lanes and things like that. I think a lot of what we're dealing with in this issue is a failure of imagination. And I don't blame people for that failure of imagination because this is all they've ever known. And so you go to them and you say, oh, we're going to take away a lane of traffic and we're going to put a bike lane or a bus lane in. And they freak out. Where are trucks going to drop off deliveries? Where ambulances is going to go? Where, you know, traffic's going to be backed up? They just can't imagine it. So we have seen advocates who have just gone out and said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to put out some traffic cones to show you where the bike lane will go and the cars will stay out of that. And look, the world has not ended. Usually the way that we present these plans is like in a high school cafeteria at 6:30 on a Wednesday on a big screen with a cross section of a street or an architectural rendering or something like that. And nobody can really imagine it because they're like, yeah, but did you know the flower shop down the road? They get deliveries every Tuesday at 8 and this bike lane's going to screw them over. Go out and just put it out. See what happens. And, you know, I think a lot of those meetings should happen in physical space. Like, we should just do more demonstration projects. I think Stevie was talking about open streets on High Street and how, like, you could talk about that till you're blue in the face, like shutting the street down to cars and opening it to people will just destroy all these businesses. If you do it, then the business could be like, wait a minute, I had three times as much foot traffic to my front door. Let's do this more often. So I think we need less talking and more doing is really my big thing.
My name's Dan Starkey, and I was just going to ask Doug and Sarah, for you guys living in New York City, or you could look at Paris as an example, who they've seen a huge increase in the number of bike lanes and stuff that are getting built. What do you see as like the most significant policy or sort of structural changes a city can make to kind of build that momentum and start getting bike network built out more quickly?
I mean, I think to a certain extent, it really has to do with the political will of the leaders, and that's the most essential characteristic. In Paris, Anne Hidalgo, who was the mayor for 12 years and just left office, and I had the privilege of interviewing her, her guiding star was quality of life for residents. She said, I want my residents to have cleaner air, access to green space, place for children to play, and access to mobility to get to jobs and healthcare and education and all the things. I want a better quality of life for my residents. And she used that when people came to her and said, how can you take cars off of the banks of the Seine where there's been a highway for 50 years? That's going to just destroy everything. But she said, you know, I want my residents to have access to the banks of the Seine and to have a park there instead. And I got elected on that platform and I'm going to follow through. And she did. And it's now one of the most beautiful, famous places to hang out in Europe. And it would be a shock if anyone were ever to say, no, this should be a highway again. And so I think that bike lanes are great and transit is great and walkability is great, open streets, all of that stuff is great, but none of it comes without the political will, leadership that's willing to take the heat and implement the designs that their forward-thinking planners are bringing to them and that advocates are advocating for.
We have 2 minutes left for one final short question and answer.
Hi, my name is Darissalon Burt, and my question is for CODA. The CODA Plus service I was convinced to use by my son, and it's a great service. I was wondering, are there any plans to expand that throughout other communities within Columbus and also increase the availability of it in the city, in the places that it's already located?
Thank you for that question. And thank you for also sharing your experience with CODA Plus. It's a great service, and it's good startup service too. Yes, there are plans to expand CODA Plus zones. We are again going through the short range transit plan. We think we will be able to do 3 more in the next 5 years. So we are just working through what it means and where. So if you have feedback, please do share where these zones will make sense in our public meetings or also online. I can share the link. Yes.
All right. Everyone, I do wish we had more time, but I'm getting the wrap-up signal. And so we're going to turn things over to Sophia to close things out.
You've been listening to the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum on 90.5 WCBE. This week, we explored how car-centered design has shaped our cities and what it could look like to put people first. We examined some bold ideas for rethinking urban transportation to build more connected, livable communities. This week, we welcomed Sarah Goodyear and Doug Gordon, the co-authors of the new national best-selling book, Life After Cars, Freeing Ourselves from the Tyranny of the Automobile. We were also joined by Devyani Puranik, the Mobility Development Program Director for COTA. Your host was Delaviance Burt Sims, board member with Transit Columbus. This week's forum was sponsored by Burgess & Nyepel, COSI, CODA, Ian Alexander Photography, and Realm Collaborative. Our forum partners were the Center for Urban and Regional Analysis at The Ohio State University, Columbus Underground, and the 2026 COSI Science Festival. The presenting sponsor of our live stream was the Center for Human Kindness at the Columbus Foundation. The Columbus Dispatch was our live stream partner. This forum was also supported by Downtown Columbus Incorporated and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. If you finish Life After Cars and you'd like to keep exploring this week's forum topic, our partners at the Columbus Metropolitan Library also recommend reading Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World by Henry Graybar. Join us next week as the not-for-profit Columbus Metropolitan Club once again connects people and ideas through community conversations. I hope you'll join us. I'm Doug Buchanan. Thanks for listening.